This episode of the Packet Pushers podcast has been sponsored by OpenGear. OpenGear designs and manufactures next-generation console servers, intelligent cellular routers, and secure remote monitoring and management appliances that enable out-of-band access anywhere, anytime. OpenGear specializes in out-of-band solutions for the data center and remote locations utilizing secure cellular connectivity to ensure network uptime. Contact OpenGear to schedule a live demo to witness for yourself how awesome these products truly are. You can find OpenGear on the web at www.opengear.com or call them on 888-346-6853. OpenGear has a blog located at blog.opengear.com and you can find them on the Twitter as @OpenGear. And if you mention the Packet Pushers podcast when you contact OpenGear for a live demo, you will receive a free OpenGear t-shirt. The Packet Pushers would like to thank OpenGear for their support of our show and the community. Welcome to Packet Pushers, the data networking podcast where real engineers get together to talk, dissect and review work life in the networking industry. And that's why it's nerdy, technical, and willfully obscure. Today, we are going to go down into the manhole that leads to the sewers of our networks, down in the places where nobody normally goes. That's right, it's the core of your network. Let's face it, the core of your network is like a woman's room. Not many network engineers have ever even been there. But it's going to be great. It's going to be great. We've packed up the clouds, folded up the silver lining, opened the windows, and we're talking switching. Hardcore goodness layer 2. This week, joining me as always is Mr. Ethan Banks. How are you, Ethan?
This is one of those weeks where I felt overwhelmed and maybe I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to go pack up my backpack and head off to the mountains and just not come out this time. Some weeks are like that where there's too many projects and too many questions and too many things coming at you and too many due dates and so on. And hey, that's the life of a network engineer. You know, that sounded terrible, but it's actually, I'm not doing all that bad, but it was just one of those weeks. You know what I'm saying?
You walked out the other end of the week and gone, yep, 5 days, and what did I do? Joining us this week is John Hudson. Good evening, John. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, thank you very much, sir. Let's see. I've been doing, some sort of thing around IT and data centers and so forth for about 18 years now. I've had the pleasure of being both on the user side, data center management, product, many different aspects of it. Joined Brocade about 2 years ago. Among other things at Brocade, I represent them in the IETF on the Trill protocol and have the pleasure of working with Ms. Perlman and several others in trying to get that protocol and in a state that everyone likes and out into the field.
Brilliant. So I'm glad we got you along. At least one of us will know something about Trill. And also with us today is Andy Sholomon. And Andy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, hi. I haven't been in the IT industry as long as you folks, I guess, but about 12 years. So not as long as John. I've mostly worked for banks before I became solutions architect here at Cisco Systems. I've been at Cisco for about 8 years. I've done everything here from sales to network consulting engineering, which is basically doing bug scrubs. And now I'm a solutions architect working mostly in data centers.
You know, when somebody says bug scrub, I always got this vision of rubber gloves and, you know, toxic compounds and massaging something.
You know? Well, also, we use a magic 8-ball.
Andy, from all of us to you, scrub harder.
Yeah.
Come on. Those are all features we put in the coding service.
Yes. They're features that aren't quite fully baked, perhaps. So we wanted to talk a little bit about Trill today, and we've got a crew here really just to focus on that protocol. What's happened is a couple of our listeners wrote in to me and said, asked us how the STP and Trill will exist or coexist into the future. We've heard a lot about Trill lately, and then all of a sudden it's gone a bit quiet, and that's to some extent due to the way the industry is moving it. Whether Trill is fully relevant, it could be replaced by OpenFlow or it could be replaced by other things. And I thought we just wanted to talk around the topics, and that's why John and Andy are with us today, to have a different perspective. So what I'll briefly do is give you a quick introduction to Trill. Trill is a successor protocol to Spanning Tree. Spanning Tree, of course, is our well-known, well-understood, much-loathed, I think, by most people. Spanning Tree's problems, of course, are due to things like relatively slow reconvergence. The tree-based architectures have a significant challenge around. When you get to the root of the tree, you have a very fat pipe that connects the root of the trees together when you go east-west. And, of course, Spanning Tree is a loop prevention protocol, but we've all experienced sometime in the last 10 years some sort of Spanning Tree loop where a lot of people have had problems. Although, it must be said that Spanning Tree has adapted in recent years with all of the new enhancements, you know, bridge protection, root bridge, BPDU guards, BPDU filtering have all added capabilities to Spanning Tree to improve its stability, and I haven't seen so much problems lately. But enter in Trill, and perhaps the key, Trill stands for Transparent Redundant Interconnection of Lots of Links. That's T-R-I-L-L. It is a IETF standard, not an IEEE standard. I guess we'll talk more about that in the near future. And its primary purpose is to solve the biggest challenge of Spanning Tree protocol, which is Layer 2 multipath. That is, it can have up to 16 equal cost paths between two points in a network that allows Layer 2 MAC frames, loop-free, guaranteed, to pass from side to side. And this means that without using Ether Channel or, you know, LACP and being bound into physical chassis limitations, such as, you know, normally you'd have to use something like an MLAG, multi-chassis link aggregation protocol, to try and get fat pipes together. Layer 2 multipath via Trill allows this to scale up to, you know, up to 16 links in a single destination for equal cost multipath. So I think, is that a fair summary, John?
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very good.
So, I mean, Trill is a complicated beast, but perhaps, John, you want to launch in to tell us a little bit about the origin story of Trill. I mean, why did Trill get birthed and arrive?
Well, it's actually kind of funny because for a lot of us, engineering and technology is such an internal passion. But the truth is that Radio Perlman is a person who is much more passionate about how easy she can make technology to use. And as a result, she takes what she's invented and the use of it actually rather personally. And what essentially started all this was a hospital in about 2001 was taken down as a result of violating some of the, Ten Commandments of bridging. And essentially for, you know, two or three days, you had doctors and nurses running around writing everything on pens and paper. And if you've seen the writing they do, you don't want your life dependent upon a doctor's handwriting. And essentially, this started her on an adventure to try to replace Spanning Tree. This resulted in what's referred to as the R-Bridge spec. Mm-hmm. She did this while she was at Sun. In 2004, she presented this to the IEEE. Where she had done her work in Spanning Tree, and she's been a member for a long time. And essentially, at that point, the establishment at the IEEE essentially rejected her idea. They did not feel that it was either. I was not there, but from what I understand, they either didn't think it was a problem or didn't like her solution. I did actually run into someone on an airplane on the way to Prague last year who told me that his problem with it at the time was that he felt that switching, routing, and should not be together. That basically routing and switching together were blasphemy, and so he just didn't like the concept. So essentially, a year later, she went to the IETF and essentially they organized a BOF, a Birds of a Feather session, and got enough people interested in her R-Bridge stuff that it took off from there and became the Trill Working Group. And that continued on from 2005, and we finally got our first RFCs in July of last year.
So it started out, I wasn't aware that Radia had actually taken it to the IEEE first. Before taking to the IETF, I figured she'd kind of had enough of the IEEE and wasn't going to bother with them again.
No. I think you could. I think you could say that her experience when presenting it to the IEEE at that point might have influenced her opinion of the IEEE. But at that point, she was still trying to push it through there.
We've got the protocol. That's where the origin of it came from. You know. Radia Perlman, who obviously was the originator of the Spanning Tree protocol when she worked at DEC, 20 years ago. I can't remember the exact years, but and now she's come back with Trill. The way that Trill fundamentally works for people is that you create a group of switches which are known as R-bridges. I've forgotten what R-bridges stands for.
A route bridge.
Route bridge. As opposed to a bridge router. Anyway, mm-hmm. So an R-bridge, which is a switch that sits at the end of the edge of the Trill core, and as MAC frames are received, the R-bridge then encapsulates them into another MAC frame and routes them across the Trill fabric, if you like, or the Trill Ethernet connectivity in the backbone. Trill relies on a version of the ISIS protocol. This is not the ISIS protocol that you learned at the foot of your first service provider network. This is an ISIS which is self-configuring, self-adapting, and requires no external tuning to make it work because it has to work at sub-millisecond speeds to get convergence going. It does work by encapsulating MAC in MAC, so it does require some hardware changes on your switches. That is, the silicon engines that encapsulate packets and push them out onto the Ethernet networks that we have are not designed to take a MAC, receive a MAC address, and then encapsulate another MAC address and send it on. That requires a silicon change up.
Well, actually, I mean, it's actually a little more than that because, I mean, most chips today will support some variant of MAC and MAC. The one big difference between Trill and something like SPB is that Trill actually has its own header. It is actually its own dedicated, self-designed header. And so it does kind of put an unfortunate pressure on the silicon designers to actually include that header in their chip or they can't support Trill.
Right, and there's another thing that happens as well, which is that a Trill is a hop-by-hop change on a packet, which doesn't happen on a regular layer 2 forwarding. So you're actually also redoing FCS hop-by-hop because you're changing the next hop MAC address on that header. So it's very much like routing in the fact that, you know, the header changes in every single hop.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, honestly, the whole perception that Trill is switching is very, it's not really correct. I mean, essentially what you have is, I mean, it's one of the reasons why some people thought it was a bit of blasphemy is because you really have basically a routing control plane merged with a switch data plane or a switch forwarding plane in that Trill is routing. I mean, it is absolutely, it is essentially just routing with MAC addresses mm-hmm. as opposed to routing with IP addresses.
I'm sorry to step on you there, but it is routing. It's not just like routing. Routing, in my perspective, at the end of the day, is more like switching. So I would say it's exactly backwards. Where routing, you have a source destination address that's a layer 3 address, obviously. And then you just rewrite the header for the next MAC address that you're going to send it to. And I think you're doing the exact same thing with Trill, where, you know, the source and destination are a MAC address, but the forwarding happens exactly the same way as it does in routing, where you're just changing the MAC address of the next hop. And, oh, by the way, you're also decrementing the per hop, you know, the number of hops you still have on the packet, right? And rewriting FCS.
Yep. Well, no, because I mean, if you actually go back to the history of all this, routing actually came out before switching. Switching came later. So in many ways, you are correct. And this is essentially routing with some switching behavior added.
So I guess that's the big change for the silicon is that not only does it have to add the header, but it now has to change the packet hop by hop, which is not what's happening on regular switching. Although, you know, a lot of switches are routers, and a lot of routers are switches, quote unquote, right?
Right.
So it's much more muddy now than it used to be. It's not the same clear-cut decision. You know, MAC address switching was always forwarding on destination MAC address, done. Okay, and routing was always forwarding on destination IP address. Very simple. And in a very real sense, Trill fits that definition. But in fact, Trill actually receives the MAC address from the source, encapsulates it in another MAC frame, or a pseudo Ethernet MAC header kind of thing, and then actually routes that MAC, that outer MAC header, across a Trill core until it gets to the designated R-bridge, in which case it then turns back into switching. And that's why.
Yeah, I mean, because the whole goal, I mean, one of Radia's very core concepts is this idea of completely non-configuration, no humans needed. And so her second very core value is this idea that it has to be able to interoperate with existing environments. So essentially, when a frame leaves a Trill cloud or a Trill campus, it should have no indication that it has gone through that Trill environment. So essentially, if you have a Trill cloud sitting between, you know, two standard bridges, essentially those two bridges should see that Trill cloud or that Trill campus as a wire. Even though it might be something much more complex than that. But essentially, that's the whole concept of the transparent interconnect, is that it's supposed to basically have no interaction at all with what it's passing through.
I think one of the things for folks to keep in mind as they try to grab a hold of Trill is the encapsulation factor.
Yes.
Greg was talking about silicon changes and so on before, and if you were to look at a Trill frame on the wire, it's got a new header that's been put on it because this is encapsulated. It's not a rewrite of the MAC address. It's in addition to one of the major features that I think we've mentioned it in passing, but it is pretty important, is there's a time to live value that's stored in there now, which is one of the loop prevention mechanisms that Trill needed to introduce.
Well, and keep in mind too that it's another difference between Trill and SPB, is that with SPB you do a reverse path forwarding check for both unicast and multicast. In Trill, we do a TTL for unicast, but we actually do a reverse path forwarding check for multicast.
Yeah, when you forward a multicast packet through a Trill environment, my understanding is you actually do have a tree structure that's there.
Well, yeah, and that's part of the challenge, is that essentially you are correct. Is that today in multicast you actually do have a much more standard tree type model. However, Tissa from Cisco, myself, and a few others published a draft maybe 3 months ago for essentially multipath multicast, and so we'll see, you know, how that evolves as it goes through the standard channel. But the goal is to eventually get multicast as dynamic in nature as the unicast stuff is.
Now, if you do a Google search for Trill and just start looking out there, I mean, you get a wide variety of opinions. Some of the arguments around, is it routing, is it switching, is it both, and even you two guys that are guests on the show today have different viewpoints on that. There was I guess I'd call it a hit piece that Juniper did. I forgot the gentleman's name, but he wrote a blog article basically saying Trill's bad, it doesn't scale, and he talks about all sorts of reasons why. Of course, Juniper would have an ulterior motive for dissing Trill, if you will. Who's really working on Trill today? I mean, what vendors have taken a look at it and said, yeah, we think we want to be a part of this?
Well, I mean, essentially, so it's evolved over time. In the beginning you had, it was essentially Cisco, Brocade, Broadcom, a few others. As time has gone on, more and more people have come on. So, for example, when we were in Taipei, Dell, with the Force 10 guys, suddenly became much more active. We've seen the HP guys become a lot more active. We've seen the IBM guys kind of ebb and flow over time. Another big difference was 2 years ago, Huawei was actually very against Trill. Then something happened. They changed their mind. And not only did they begin to support Trill, but they actually hired Donald Eastlake, who's the co-chair of the Trill Working Group, and essentially started putting many, many, many of their employees within the Trill kind of framework, to the point that last IETF meeting, I think maybe 40-50% of the drafts that were actually presented at the meeting were actually from Huawei employees. So essentially at this point, you have, you know, all the silicon vendors, the Marvels and Broadcoms and Fulcrums, and you have, Blade IBM, you have Dell, Force 10. Recently, we've seen Extreme start to get involved. Cisco, Brocade, essentially everyone except for Arista and Juniper. And, of course, Avaya and Alcatel-Lucent, because Avaya and Alcatel-Lucent are very pro-SPB, whereas HP tends to kind of say that they'll play in both fields. Huawei says they'll play in both fields. But
HP's got an imperative there. They are very keen to follow the IEEE and are very heavily involved. And they've got some good resources involved in the IEEE that they can leverage. And they like that. So if people would like to hear more about shortest path bridging, you could refer back to show 44 of the Packet Pushers, where we had a show on the case for shortest path bridging, and we actually had Peter Ashwood-Smith from Huawei on talking about it, as well as Roger LePou and Paul Umberhagen from Avaya and Alcatel-Lucent, who are talking about the advantages and putting the case for SPB. And, you know, I guess we, if you would like to know more about it, refer to that. But Trill's really got the bulk of the market momentum. Most of the vendors are behind. In terms of delivering, there are most vendors are delivering products around Trill, having thrown their weight behind that, not behind shortest path bridging.
Well, products behind Trill, but I think it's fair to also add that it's everybody's flavor of Trill. But we're not at a standards point yet, so it's not like all of these products are interoperable at this point.
Oh no, I was going to say I'm really hoping that toward the end of 2012 we're going to really see that start to change. In that, essentially, part of the confusion is that what Brocade and Cisco did is they came out with new product suites that were built on top of Trill. So they took Trill, or a pre-standard version of Trill, added a bunch of other features. Cisco wrapped it together and released it as Fabric Path. We wrapped it together and released it as VCS. And unfortunately, that kind of muddied the water a bit as to what features are actually in Trill and what features are kind of the added, you know, quote-unquote value add that these companies added. If you really look at basic Trill, it's very much what was said earlier, and it's actually very simple. It's NCAP, DCAP, loop removal, multipath, get out, get in, and so forth.
And a routing protocol so that everybody knows who's got what MAC addresses. Because
And because that's the only thing that scales, right? Yes. I mean, Radia herself didn't like spanning tree. I mean, I know that sounds funny since she invented it, but essentially she firmly believes in routing. And so there's a very good reason as to why it is routing, is because it's the only thing that scales. Now, this year, you're going to start seeing products from companies like Extreme and Force 10 and Huawei and Blade and other companies that are going to be open Trill. They're going to be actually IETF Trill. Right. And while I haven't seen the implementation yet, I'm hoping that they are thorough. And then we can start doing plug fests, and we can start, you know, really start looking at how we can start bringing this all together.
And actually, just as a side note, John, maybe you can clear this up for me. I actually went back and read the RFC yesterday because, you know, I wanted to be somewhat informed for the show, and I never found
my condolences.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was interesting. So I'm a bit confused because one of the things that somebody set up in the front of the show was that it was 16 paths, blah blah blah, to forward everything ECMP, and I read an appendix there that I had to read it three times. There's an appendix to that RFC that says implementation of multipathing is actually optional, and that's Appendix C, right? So is that – did I misunderstand that?
No. So the thing you have to remember is that you know, standards committees are used by three different groups. You have the academics that I think that Radia probably falls into the camp of that are really about the science. They're really about the algorithms and the purity and the beauty of it. And then you have a group like me who essentially used to be users. And so we're really focused on making it easy to use and making it actually applicable and creating something that people actually would care about. And then you do unfortunately have a group of people that are there to essentially use it to beat their competition over the head with. And so as a result, there's always this process that we go through where we'll come down to a feature that we believe that it should be done this way. And then we'll say, oh, but you know, we can't really be that specific. So we'll open up this section and say, but individual implementations may vary. And so essentially what you have is this is why you see words like may and must and these kind of directive words in these documents, is that there are certain things that you absolutely have to do to qualify as being standards compliant. And then there's other things that are, you know, they're kind of, you know, more suggestions than rules, as someone might say. So that's kind of where some of the muddiness comes up.
Right, and it's an interesting thing because everywhere I hear about Trill, I hear 16 paths and all that good stuff. And actually, that's not one of the things that's in the spec. The spec says, you know, you can do whatever you want on that. Now, 16 seems to be the number that I've heard from multiple vendors, and it seems to be the one that is going to be implemented. But
part of that's too because essentially the prescribed method is by using ECMP. And ECMP is not a Trill invention, right? So, I mean, part of this is the history of ECMP and the history of multipathing in general.
Exactly. So that's one of the things I wanted to clear up for people because ECMP has nothing to do with Trill. I think Trill allows ECMP to work. As a matter of fact, it just makes it easier to work at layer 2. I mean, that's my personal opinion.
Yeah, no, no. And essentially, but I mean, that's essentially what you have with Trill is you have, because of the people involved, because many of them, I mean, you know, Donald Eastlake is the author of I believe, 57 RFCs. You know, obviously, Radio's been around for a while. We've had some other really sharp people. Dinesh Dutt, who just left Cisco, who's one of the core Cisco guys on the VXLAN draft, was instrumental in the early days of Trill. So essentially, you had a lot of really bright people working on this, and so they didn't reinvent the wheel. When they needed a link state routing protocol, they said, oh, look, ISIS is fine. We'll just use that. When they needed multipathing, they said, oh, look, we have ECMP. That's just fine. And so they tried to do their best to essentially, you know, use existing technology where it was suitable. So there wasn't a tremendous amount of reinvention going on.
And that's the advantage of ISIS is that we are able to reuse, you know, the people who put together the software that runs in our switches will be able to reuse at least some part of the code that exists in ISIS today.
Absolutely.
And that's why that protocol was chosen. They didn't go and develop a new, whole new protocol. It made sense to reuse ISIS. And if you haven't listened to the OSPF versus ISIS show, which will come out in the next sometime in late February, early March, you probably should go and have a listen to that because that's where we talk a lot more about ISIS in detail. And
You actually cover one of the specific reasons why it was used, and that is that whereas as OSPF is more IP focused, ISIS is not. ISIS doesn't really care what its objects of base are, and so it made it very, very easy to we had to make some very minor changes into the ISIS protocol to essentially allow it to be used, whereas some other link state protocols would have required a lot more work.
Well, you know,
yeah, my perspective on that is ISIS does not need an IP address, period, end of story. It simplifies it.
Yep, agreed.
So it's kind of like an auto configuration layer 2 protocol, does not require you to put an IP address to create an adjacency. So from that perspective, if you think about, I guess maybe we're jumping a little bit ahead, but if you think about of a core R bridge, technically it doesn't have to have an IP address at all. Right.
Nope.
And that's the beauty of ISIS for this particular implementation.
Yep. No, I mean, it's essentially, depending on how you want to set it up, essentially it would only be your edge devices that would need any sort of IP type device.
If I remember, the router ID is actually derived from the MAC address, isn't it?
Yeah, everything's MAC address based.
That's right. So the ISIS router ID is derived from a MAC address of the system. You know, which are globally unique. You don't need to. You know, the only reason we use an IP address is to make sure that all instances of your link state protocol, such as OSPF or ISIS, is only there to make sure you've got a unique router ID, and that requires manual configuration.
Yep, correct. I mean, now, there are, once again, there are some implementation options. And, you know, right now there's a lot of discussion going on how we want to do multi-topology or multi-level Trill, and looking at, you know, as far as, there's this concept of nicknames, there's a namespace concept, and essentially how do we deal with scaling that, and how do we essentially, you know, repeat that in multiple environments without causing confusion and so forth. And so there is some implementation option, but the goal is always in every single thing that is done is how do we create it in a way that you don't need humans.
Okay. So let's look a bit more at the practical parts of Trill. So just to recap, we know that spanning tree is what we've got today. We know that spanning tree isn't going to go away. A lot of people have the view that Trill will replace spanning tree, but we still need to have a loop prevention mechanism that faces externally towards the host, just in case somebody patches a lead. Is that correct?
Well, I mean that is the current stage, right? You know, as much as we would all like a new invention to come out and for the whole world to swap over in 9 months, this takes a long time. Most production data centers have a change rate of 2%, and so the goal is eventually for Trill to completely replace Spanning Tree. I mean, essentially, long term, the goal is, as you know, as I joke sometimes, the complete eradication of Spanning Tree from the planet. At the Ethernet Technology Summit last week,
a lofty but noble goal.
Yes,
yes, lofty indeed.
last week at the Ethernet Technology Summit, there was a slide that went up saying, you know, Spanning Tree. What was said? Oh, Spanning Tree's dead. Essentially, it's a roaming zombie that doesn't realize it's dead, and someone needs to put it down. So essentially, there is a, you know, as was said before, there's a lot of love for Spanning Tree in the world. Mm. But this is going to take probably, you know, 10 years. I mean, Spanning Tree is
That's very optimistic. I would have said 30.
Oh, no, and you might be right. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Spanning Tree runs in the streetlights. I mean, it's everywhere.
Yep.
So it's going to take a long time to, but the goal is eventually to completely replace Spanning Tree with Trill.
So where a server connects at the access layer, right? Normally we would run Spanning Tree there just in case somebody makes a mistake. You're saying Trill will run on that interface as well and it will do its own loop prevention.
Well, you'll have one of two things occur. Either you'll start to we've been working on a concept of this idea of a mini R bridge or a virtual R bridge or a kind of you know, some kind of a separate construct that can participate but doesn't actually isn't really a fully promoted R bridge. And so you might start to see, there's a draft I've been playing with for a while, the idea of basically turning a hypervisor into a kind of a mini R bridge of sorts. So you will eventually see Trill push down to the host level. But if you look at what most vendors are implementing today, essentially from the top of rack switch to the actual host, you have some sort of lag or you know some sort of a host channel type load balancing algorithm that's set up between the interface cards and the top of rack switch. So I'm not really sure where the market will pull it, but both of them will be available.
But for today, if somebody's looking at it in the next 5 years, it'll be Spanning Tree on the access ports towards the servers, and Trill will run on the upstream core, on the upstream towards the access or towards the distribution in the core layers.
Or essentially a lag, some sort of a lag between the host and the top of rack switch. I have a lot of customers today that run no Spanning Tree at all.
Wow, that's a statement. I always tell everybody, make sure you don't need Spanning Tree, but keep it turned on.
Well, no, but I mean, I have customers that don't run Spanning Tree that are not running Trill. I mean, I have customers that have gone through other rather painful methods to get rid of Spanning Tree long before Trill came around. So you've seen a push for a kind of a Spanning Tree free environment for a number of years.
It's not very practical in some ways, but in other ways it's possible. So if you've had a major outage and lost millions because of an STP loop problem for whatever reason, then you might re-architect your entire application so that it only needs layer 3, in which case you don't need any loop prevention except locally within the chassis, so you can turn it off because even any impacts are sorted out by a layer 3 backbone. So a pure layer 3 backbone is effectively where you're heading. So
not easy, but possible.
Possible, yes. Implausible, yes, would be the word I would reach for.
I'm laughing here because, you know, it's fantasy to me.
you may laugh, but I actually have worked for customers who just will not enable Spanning Tree. They actually deliberately turn it off on their core switches because they feel that it's more risky to have Spanning Tree enabled than it is to have somebody create their own loop and have a meltdown because of that. Rightly or wrongly, that's the perception. So,
but people still have cables and they still connect their own hubs off of their desks.
Yeah, but then there's somebody to blame then. Right. Yeah. So, as the guy who works in the help desk, right, and you get a call at 4 o'clock in the morning saying that a loop's happened, and you say, right, who's in the data center, and you can go and blame him, and then you can sack him, and it's not my fault. So, cheer, give me 3 cheers for that, right?
Well, and actually, you bring up a good point with users plugging in hubs. I mean, today, essentially, all of this quote-unquote, Ethernet fabric or fabric technology is essentially in the data center and, in the large, service provider-style data center environments. You're not seeing it to cubes in a building, right? So essentially, most of these environments, there aren't users that can come in and plug a hub, right? It's just basically a secure data center that's fairly locked down.
Yeah, theoretically at least.
The thing that we are seeing more of is using a, well, in our case, it's Fabric Bath, but a Trill-like mechanism to split up the users and keep those loops local. So that seems to be more of a use case day one from a user perspective. Obviously, from the data mm-hmm. center perspective, is what we said.
So what you're doing there is engineering the failure domains to be smaller. So by having, exactly. You'll have a pair of switches over here at the root of a spanning tree, and then there'll be a cascade down of, you know, distribution and access or whatever it is, however you want to architect your data center to have two or three layers. Three would be silly, but there you go. So you have two, and then that's the root of that spanning tree. And then when you have a Trill backbone, the next two switches that are on the other side are then another SDP domain that's completely isolated from the other one. And so you, exactly. if something happens to an SDP domain, you've only lost that tree, not the entire data center, because right. it's not just a single tree.
Exactly, and that's thus limiting your failure domain, and still, you know, having the spanning tree as a, in this case, almost a tertiary backup, right? Hmm. So that when that guy does plug in that hub, which happens, I mean, everyone has had that conversation, right?
Yeah.
At least you can keep that, A, you can hopefully negate that, and B, if you don't, you can keep your failure domain fairly small.
Okay.
And on a you know, on a trading floor, that's a very important thing to have, right? You want to keep that fairly small. And so it depends on your user and your user case. And that's not just another way of using you know, Trill or Trill-like behavior to improve your design.
Yep. No, and that's the other thing too, is that you never know. You know, I mean, you're sitting in a room and you're arguing over whether it should be, you know, 3 bits or 2, and you never really know where these protocols are going to end up and how they're going to be used. For example, you know, me personally, I expected to see a similar sort of evolution of spanning tree. Of Trill and SPB as we saw with OSPF and ISIS, where essentially I expected to see SPB. Get more service provider carrier type features and kind of gravitate in that direction. And I expected to see Trill focus more on the data center and gravitate toward that direction. But because of the fact that you have so many of these large exchanges in Europe that have these very large aggregation layers that essentially they don't want to route in. They just essentially want these fast layer two interconnects. And a lot of them still run spanning tree today. And not only does it, cause them some risk, but for a lot of them, it's money, right? They don't want to have, paths shut off. And so I've been personally quite shocked the number of internet exchanges throughout Europe that have been approaching either the Trill Working Group or, us at Brocade for how they can use Trill within that sort of context. And so you never know, where it might pop up or where people might find value.
That's a regular topic on this show, because the American telecommunications market is radically different to the European market. It's very different.
Yes.
Right? And it always bothers me when people in America don't know that there's actually a whole wide world out there that looks very different, because I find that offensive. Oh. But, that's just me.
No, I mean, it's amazing. I mean, the other day I was meeting with a guy from an exchange in the Czech Republic, and looking at some of the stuff he was doing, and my God, I mean, the load and the number of devices and just the complexity of his environment was very impressive. And here he is, sitting in his own little corner of the world, and most people don't give him any time, and it's quite silly, because essentially there's a lot of cool people doing really smart stuff.
Well, one of those places are doing things that nobody's thought of, because they have to do more with less. And they just keep driving in, and then all of a sudden they've got problems that AT&T will hit in about 10 years' time. And they've got AT&T's got the luxury to sit back and do everything right and take its time and waste lots of money with project managers and ITIL consultants to fiddle around with this and that. And then there's people in certain parts of the world who just get on with it and get it done. I've seen this time and time and time again. So coming back to where Trill could and should be in the data center, one of the things that it's probably worth remembering about Trill is that you need typically at least 6 switches to make it work. You could make it work with 4, because you need to have, and I've got the virtual whiteboard out here, and I've got pens in left and right hand, right? So you listen, make sure you've got the virtual whiteboard in mind. You'd have to have a pair of switches on the left and a pair of switches on the right, and you would have a full cross connect. So you'd have 2 horizontals and 2 crosses in the middle, and that would give you a 4-path layer 2 multipath solution between the left and the right. But Trill really only scales up when you've got 6 switches in 3 set, you know, whether you can, and typically you'd dual home everything so that you would then fan out for STP domains away from that. And then you would fully connect again. And that's to do that, you really need to have a network core that's got at least 4 switches in the network core and preferably 6 before Trill starts to kick in, because you've got to have enough switches in the middle that are Trill-enabled, and the switches that are Trill-enabled today are your big iron, so the big chassis-based switches, which actually have the new silicon, which have the blades.
Well, so I would differ with you a bit there, in that essentially because it's new, I find customers tend to do it in smaller type deployments. Sometimes just, 2 top of rack switches or mm-hmm. 4 or 6 top of rack switches. And in actuality, for most of the implementations, it's actually been the 1U and 2U fixed port switches that have implemented Trill first.
So patches of
the
green.
The chassis ones have been later coming.
We did it a little bit backwards at Cisco, but then again, it's not Trill, it's FabricPath, so I won't comment on that.
Wasn't FabricPath enabled on the 3000s, 5000s before it was on 7000s the
7000s first? No, 7000s.
Oh, really?
First.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
The 5548 and the 5 just came out. The code came out fairly recently.
So you could do it that way, but you still need to have more than just 2 switches to make that work. You need to have enough to make it scale out. Went on for a good 100 minutes, 110 minutes, and it's really a bit too long to put down in a single show, so I've decided to crack it into 2 pieces. Just after the end of the music, I'm actually going to put in a piece about what the packet pushes is about, because I was asked during the show, and I was explaining to the guys a little bit about why we started packet pushes. So if you want to tune in, please do. Otherwise, it does sound a little bit egocentric, so I apologize for that, but I was asked to say why we do the packet pushes and what it's all about. So I thought I'd just drop it in on the end of the show for people who wish to listen. As always, you can leave feedback on today's show on the blog post on the packet pushes website at packetpushes.net. You can follow us on Twitter for updates and nerdy retweets as @packetpushes. You can also find us on Google Plus and also LinkedIn and various other places around the internet. You can leave feedback by sending us email to packetpushes@gmail.com, and of course always remember that too much networking would never be enough. We're in a position to have mentor young people and bring them on. And so this is our way of sharing stuff with the community and encouraging people to participate in networking and to make networking, this data networking business that we live in, something where it's shared and there's community and people can put ideas forward and share that with each other. And that's the idea behind the packet pushes.
And never say never. I would not be at all surprised if this ends up being full time for one or many of you if you like doing it, because it's amazing. To me, it's a really phenomenal thing to see something like your show, which is kind of the definition of a grassroots sort of user based sort of thing, talked about in meetings and all these very official places and so forth. You guys are really making an impact. It's good stuff.